on July 4th, he tried to escape going over the stockade, and he was captured by bloodhounds and brought back to camp and tied to a log in the guardhouse. And right there, there's a picture. It's like, oh my God, you know, this is my ancestor, and this is what happened to him. And it's ironic that it was on the 4th of July that he was not independent. But and then he finally was successful on August 8th of 1864. He and another guy got someone to cover them up in the dump cart, and they were wheeled out of the prison and left with the garbage. So the dump cart was the garbage cart. And then it took him a month to walk across Indian territory, what is now Oklahoma, from Texas to get to report back to Union lines.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. A hot drink can become cool in two primary ways, through conduction and convection. Conduction occurs when two objects touch each other. Imagine holding a piece of ice. Before long, your fingers are cold and the ice begins to melt. That's conduction. Convection occurs when a gas or liquid moves from being different temperatures. When you heat water over a stove, the warm water moves up and the cool water moves down. That's what you're seeing when water boils, and that's convection. A stainless vacuum bottle prevents conduction from occurring by creating a void between the walls of the bottle, thermos, or cup and the outside air. It prevents convection by keeping all the liquid inside at the same temperature. That's how a Stanley product keeps your cold drink cold and your hot drink hot. And they've been doing it for 110 years. The Six Ranch Podcast is brought to you by Stanley 1913, and you can check out their new and classic line of products at stanley1913.com.
How are you doing, ma'am?
I am doing really good. I'm glad to be here with you.
Yeah, likewise. You have knowledge that I'm super, super interested in, and I think that a lot of people will too, but let's start off with Cindy's List and what that is, and then we'll get into how it became.
Okay. Well, Cindy's List is a free research portal online for genealogy. I've got around 320,000 categorized links. So back when I started it, I can give you the history on it a little bit, but it was basically to make it easier for people to find things online to help them in their genealogical research. And it's been free. It's 27 years old. I categorize and cross-reference everything. So I dig deep into websites and find collections, manuscript collections, old diaries, letters. There's so many things that are online now that's available for research, but digging deep into stuff and linking to it so that people can find it easier than just using Google. Google doesn't always, depending on the algorithms, does not always make it easy for people to find things that they need for a specific ancestor. So,
yeah, no, Google can be a really tricky thing to navigate, any of these search engines, because while it feels like it's free, it's not. And the thing that I commonly tell people is that if you're getting something for free, you are the product. And with Google, they're going to send you to places that make them some more money.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's money wise and also a popularity wise, you know, algorithm goes into that too. But sometimes there's something buried deep within like a university library, university archives website. That's like a terrific set of a collection of personal papers for somebody or the history of a certain area or region, and they're not brought up to the top. You might find them eventually by Googling for them, but you have to really dig. So I take my experience of 43 years and I apply that to what do genealogists want to find, and then I try to make it easier for them to find it.
What got you interested in this?
Your great-grandmother. So my grandma, my grandma Nash, Ruth Laverne Johnson was her maiden name. In 1963, when I was born, Grandma got these red vinyl family tree books, and she got one for herself, and then she got one for each of her four children. And I think the one for your family likely burned in the fire that Uncle Lyman and Aunt Janie had at the time. But my mom had one, And then her sister and brother and so on. But grandma was really good about filling out hers. And she stuffed it full. I mean, she did newspaper clippings. She filled in everything. So I can remember being fascinated with when I saw her book, but the one that she gave to my mother was very similar, the same book, but my mom had filled it out. Just as a kid, I was always fascinated with that. Grandma also wrote that same year in 63, she wrote to her cousins that were still living and asked them for family history information. And those were in letters, handwritten letters that were stuffed in the back of this book. So fast forward a bit to 1980, I was in high school, 17 years old, and we had a civics class, contemporary world problems. And it was, I think the objective of the family tree project that we did was to show, you know, the various ethnicities that we have, where what our backgrounds are, where we come from in the world. And so I got to do a family tree and I still have that chart. But that's really where it hooked me in 1980. It was like, I've been doing it ever since. So using grandma's book and using the people that were still alive by 1980, both Nash grandparents were gone. So I didn't have them to ask. So it's so valuable that I got the stuff that she put together all those years before to kind of help push me forward on it.
So I don't know whether it's ironic or a genetic form of justice that it sounds like interest in genealogy is in your genes.
I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it's in my DNA. I really do.
Yeah.
I can remember though, even as a kid, I liked to sit with the old people and listen to the stories. I didn't go off and play with the other kids like at Christmas and things up here with my dad's family. I like going and sitting and listening to my grandma, listening to older people talk about things.
One of the great things about stories, that oral tradition in our family, is that they're all lies. So they're told a little bit differently every time. So you never get to hear the same story twice, even if it sounds like it's the same. It's like, oh, what kind of twist are we going to put it on it for Thanksgiving 2022?
Your grandfather, my Uncle Lyman, was really good at those stories and taking them. In part of it, this is not just in our family. This is everywhere. The family stories that get passed down. And on one hand, they get embellished because they sound better if you add this little bit or this little tidbit of news or nugget, or you try to tie it to a famous person or something in history. It sounds better. There's always, though, a grain of truth in every family story. There's some nugget in there. You just have to dig through it. And that's part of what I do, is trying to figure out, okay, which part of this is true? And then go looking for any records that might help prove it, or building a timeline for that person's life and going with it. Every family's got some story that's been embellished, or that's been a lie, or has been kind of maybe to hide some family secrets, or make something sound better than maybe it actually was. It's not uncommon. So genealogists spend a lot of time trying to either prove or disprove, or at least straighten out the truth. Yeah. There's also, it's kind of like the telephone game. You know, when you say something at one end and you pass it to the next person and they repeat it to the next person, by the time you get 10 down, they've heard it slightly different. And so you get that. You also get siblings. I bet you have that with you and your sister, where you don't remember the same event exactly the same way. My brother and I will talk about certain Christmases and he remembers one thing and I remember something slightly different. So when you take those differences in memories and you put them with the family stories, they get passed down in that telephone game over five or six generations, and they're not quite the same when they get to the other end.
I really enjoy military history because it's a good stream to take you through the history of mankind for the most part, you know, at least the last 10,000 years or so. And it also helps me understand better my own experience in the military and in combat, and to wrap that up into this larger experience of the species.
Yeah.
But military history is hard for me because when I read about specific battles or incidents and some of the details that are written in nonfiction is what I'm talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, man, how could you possibly come up with that? Because it was part of my job as an officer at the end of the day to write down what happened that day. And I would have to sit down with all the tank commanders and be like, all right, what do you think happened? What do you think happened? And everybody would have a different take on something that we had all observed.
Yes.
With the utmost focus. And then you kind of try to piece together the timeline of events, and you can go back and look at, like, you know, where your GPS was at the time. During the Civil War, for example, I cannot imagine the chaos on those battlefields with so many wounded, so many dead, so many ill, and no means of communication other than, couriers and paper notes. And those notes were often destroyed as soon as somebody read them so that they didn't fall into somebody else's hands. So history's tough. It's complicated. I want to do two things on this show. And I usually don't have any kind of an agenda for shows because I've learned my lesson the hard way that the best laid plans get thrown to the side. But I'm going to tell you right off the bat what the two things are that I want. First, I want you to tell me about my family's history. And then I want you to tell us all ways that people can go about researching their own family's history for those who are interested.
Okay.
Think we
All
can
right.
hammer on that for an hour?
Yeah. Well, I could go on for about 6 or 7 hours. So just
Yeah.
sit tight,
Okay.
and because this is near and dear to my heart. I was hooked, like I said, from 17 years old on. So I've been doing this. I'm 38. So how many years is that? I don't know. I've been doing this 43 years. There's a couple of things. So I've got that book that Grandma Nash had filled out, and there's a lot of stuff in that book that's wrong that she got from her husband. So Granddad Nash, your great grandfather, was a good storyteller as well.
This is Chief.
Chief, yeah,
Yep.
Chief T. Nash. For one, he was born his birth register in Hennepin County, Minnesota says Baby Nash, so he could be anybody he wanted to. His name was Otto Thaddeus Nash, and he hated it, which isn't surprising. And he was born in 1902. And we go through the World War I and World War II. We weren't real fond of Germany or German names at that time. So I don't know if that's what influenced it or he just didn't like it. But his childhood nickname was Chief, and that's what he went by. So when he applied for Social Security in 1937 or 38, he applied under Chief T. Nash, and every other record is in that name from then on.
Wow.
So that's his name. That's what he went by. But that's one of the things. My mother never knew her father's name until after he died. Because he hated it so much, it was like, don't repeat it. I don't want anyone to know. So that's like some of the little lies and things that come out in some of the storytelling. But so I took everything at the beginning as gospel truth. Anything grandma wrote in the book, grandma wouldn't lie, right? So it's all true. But she got information from her husband about his mom's siblings and his dad's siblings. Most all of it's wrong. He claimed Indian Native American ancestry. We do not have that in our family. But what we do have, and what's interesting to me on most of it, is we've always lived near Native American areas and interacted with them. Their time after they were married in 1926 and they went to Canada. Your grandfather and Uncle Lionel were both born in Canada, and they lived up in near Prince Albert in Saskatchewan, way up in Saskatchewan. And they dealt with Indians and Native Americans in that area quite a bit. He grew up in an area in Minnesota that there was a lot of populations of Native Americans there. And his father, no, not his father, his grandfather and his grandfather's brother. So James H. Nash and Thomas Wesley Nash. Would be they're my second great grandparents. They're your James H. is your third great grandfather. They both participated in the Dakota Indian Wars in 1862. In Blue Earth County, Minnesota, there was reservation land. And this is new to me. I'm still learning all of this. I've got a book here, Massacre in Minnesota, that talks about the Dakota Wars. But they were trying to get land and trying to get land away from the Native Americans. Anyway, there was a big kerfuffle. I'm reading about it. It was a terrible conflict, but they participated in that as soldiers. And that was in 1862. And they got land in Blue Earth County after that. And then both of them, it looks like I was reviewing the pension files and the military files today before talking to you. It looks like they both were drafted. They were looking for soldiers by 1864 out of Minnesota because the Civil Wars started in 1861. And they were off fighting with the Indians and the Dakotas instead. And then by 64, they needed more. So both men ended up volunteering for Company D, the 1st Minnesota Heavy Artillery. And they spent the rest of the time in that unit in the Civil War. And then they were discharged in 1865. Both of them were in Nashville for quite a while. They had some lung issues. They were in hospital. So I'm not sure how much fighting or how much of the war that they saw there, but I needed to learn more about it and what it meant to be part of the heavy artillery. You'd know more about that than I would, but They came back, James H. Nash, which we believe his middle name was also Henry. His son's name was James Henry, your second great grandfather. He was born in 1873, and his dad died just before he was born or just after. So he didn't ever know his dad. So our direct ancestor, from his Civil War experience and his experience with the Dakota Wars, he came back. He was never the same. He didn't do well, and he died by 1873. And so the sad part of that, you know, obviously he died young and he left 8 kids, but his wife after that, you know, genealogically, it's a good thing. She had to apply for his pension. So we've got this huge, thick pension file that tells the story of his life and their kids and who they were and all of this sort of thing. And she struggled for most of the rest of her time. Her sister married his brother, Thomas Wesley. They ended up out in Newburgh, Oregon, and he was a minister. And so he lived a much longer life, but he also had suffered quite a bit after the war with health issues and some lung issues and that kind of thing. So you get a picture of them through their Civil War pension files of what their life was like. Not as much what they were like as a soldier, but after the war and what they went through and how they tried to survive. We follow them through records like that. We follow them through records like land records, seeing where they bought and sold land, what they tried to farm, how they tried to make a living, and what initially drove them west. In our family, in our Nash family, the earliest I've got is in Connecticut, in Ridgefield, Fairfield County, Connecticut, which is on the western end of Connecticut, right next to New York. Abraham Nash and Rhoda Keeler. And they had 11 children, I believe. I got to look it up, but 11 kids. Their son, Ezra, married Mehitable Kellogg. I love that name, Mehitable. And they ended up in New York, going up the Hudson to Saratoga County. And Ezra and 3 of his brothers all participated in the American Revolution. And at varying levels, it looks to me like, and again, this is all new research there too. It looks like he participated in a militia. It looks like they gave supplies to soldiers. But Saratoga County, if you read any of the history, the American Revolution, there was a lot going on there. So Ezra, his brother Jacob, who died in Connecticut, his brother Jonathan, his brother Samuel, all participated. And it looks like they're also saying their father, Abraham, participated in the Revolutionary War. He's buried in the soldier area in Old Titicus Cemetery in Ridgefield. So we've got Revolutionary War soldiers, and then our line is the one that always ended up going west. So Ezra went west from Connecticut to New York. Ezra's son, Joshua, there we go. Joshua's the one that I'm a little bit, he's hard to find in the records, but I've got him buying land in Oswego County, New York, which is on the shores of Lake Ontario. So he's moving western New York, and then he ends up in Wisconsin. His kids end up in Wisconsin, then Minnesota, and then all the way out to Oregon. And just last week, I was talking about Joshua online on a Facebook group, and I had a lady said, "Cindy, that's my ancestor." And she lives up in Friday Harbor, up in the San Juans here in Washington. And what's interesting to me is how many of these Nashes all ended up out in Washington and Oregon. How many of us were driven to keep doing better, getting land, doing better, finding a better way to live, all of that, until we hit the ocean. We couldn't go for any further west than where we are now, James.
Yeah.
But all participating when we needed to in the military events of our nation, and then also participating in making the nation bigger and stronger and so on. It's something that makes me really proud of our family. On Grandma Nash's side, Grandma Ruth Laverne Johnson, she's got Swedish grandparents. Those are the only recent immigrants. For the most part, most of our lines have all been here since the early days. When I go back and look at Abraham Nash, he was born in 1718 in Connecticut. And his father, which I don't have any information on, would have probably participated. Father and or brothers would have also probably participated in those early colonial issues as we were moving west. So it's fascinating to me. The one that got me, though, James, and the one that still gets me, my favorite ancestor is your fourth great grandfather, Xerxes Knox.
Xerxes. Wow.
Xerxes Knox. Xerxes. Yeah. Knox. And he was like from Exira, Iowa.
The king of Persia.
He is. He was born in 1834. at that time, there was kind of a, you could see a pattern in naming of people, of boys during that time after classical names in literature. You might have heard of Ulysses S. Grant. That was another one, same contemporary, right? Okay, so Xerxes, what we had in that book of Graham and Nash's, that Red Vinyl Family Tree book, was this letter that she'd written to Grant Knox, who was in Long Beach, California at the time in 1963. And she said, tell me about, you know, the family. And he wrote back his father's name, his mother's name, and that Xerxes was a soldier in the Civil War. That's it. And so when I was up researching, so this is about 1988, 1990, I was at the National Archives branch in Seattle, and they had on microfilm this index, a general index to pensions. And I had a few minutes left at the end of the day, and I thought I'd ask, well, I've got this supposedly the Civil War soldier. What do I do? And she said, well, you look in the pensions to see if he got a pension. If they live past the war, they would be there if they were Union soldiers. And supposedly he was from Iowa. And so I went and I pulled it up. There is only one Xerxes Knox that ever existed, and he's ours. And so I said, okay, I found him on the index. Now what do? Order the pension file. So I sent away to the National Archives in Washington, D.C. And at that time, you would send and they'd give you 20 odd pages for a certain fee. And they'd tell you, there's so many more pages. Do you also want those? It'll cost you this much. And I think I spent 70 bucks on that file, which at that time was a lot of money for me, but they sent it to me. I don't know how we get to this point where we don't know this about a person, where the stories don't get passed down. And I don't know from your own experience, James, how you are about talking about your military service. I'm sure it's hard. I'm sure it's emotional. I'm sure it's disturbing. Things you saw, things you went through, things you did. And so I don't think those stories always come down. And yet I got it from his pension file. I'm probably gonna start crying because I totally love this man. Like, I feel like I know him inside and out. So he served from, he enlisted right away in 1861 at Keokuk, Iowa, in Company G of the 3rd Iowa Cavalry. And he served in the West, what we call the Western Theater in the Civil War. So he was in Missouri. You know, he wasn't, you know, in Gettysburg and those areas. He was in Missouri all the way down to Arkansas. And he enlisted for the 3-year term. And in 1864, in April, May, I got to look up the exact dates. They were down in Arkansas. They were in the Little Rock area. And General Steele had his Red River campaign where they had, you might want to read up on this because it's interesting, but they were going in and trying, and it was a disaster. It did not go well. And a bunch of Iowa soldiers were taken prisoner at Camden, Arkansas, and they were marched on foot to Tyler, Texas. That's quite a few miles. That's 200 and some miles, whatever it is. I'm going to have to go Google that one again to see the distance. But they were marched on foot to Tyler, Texas, and they were held prisoner at Camp Ford. In that area, they used all the trees in that area. I studied, in order to do genealogy too, you don't just study the person. You study the history of what they're involved in, his military unit, the history of what they're doing. And in this case, I did a bunch of history on and research on Camp Ford. So it's a Confederate prisoner of war camp. It was relatively new when he was first taken there. They used every tree in the area there to build a stockade and to build the officers' cabins and that sort of thing. And then after that, any other soldiers coming in basically lived in dirt dugouts. There was nothing to make shelter for them. And so they kind of had areas. They had a creek running through the middle of camp where they got their water and where other things probably happened. So it wasn't necessarily clean water. They had somewhat decent rations at the beginning when he was first there. By, it was April when he was first taken prisoner. So I think he's getting there in May. By July, and this is all in his pension file. This is eyewitnesses to what happened to him writing later as he's applying for a pension 20, 25, 30 years later, asking for the government to pay him his pension. He's having to say, I was a prisoner and I have, well, how do we know you were a prisoner? Like, where's your proof? Well, he'd have affidavits signed by people. So they're describing what they saw. And one of them is a description saying that on July 4th, he tried to escape going over the stockade and he was captured by bloodhounds and brought back to camp and tied to a log in the guardhouse. And right there, there's a picture. It's like, oh my God, you know, this is my ancestor and this is what happened to him. And it's ironic that it was on the 4th of July that he was not independent, but. And then he finally was successful on August 8th of 1864. He and another guy got someone to cover them up in the dump cart and they were wheeled out of the prison and left with the garbage. So the dump cart was the garbage cart. And then it took him a month to walk across Indian Territory, what is now Oklahoma, from Texas to get to report back to Union lines. Over a month of him walking, and I'm thinking he's been held prisoner on meager rations. He's probably had really, you know, disease-ridden water. He's who knows how his shoes or his boots or his clothes are. And you're traveling across this dangerous stretch of land to get back to Union lines. He reports back. They send him off to Cairo, Illinois. They send him back to Tennessee to be checked out by doctors. And then he's sent to Davenport, Iowa, where he's mustered out. And I'm sitting there realizing, as I'm reading this pension file, nobody in our family knows this. Here's this amazing feat this man did. He's my third great-grandfather. We've got four grandparents. We've got eight great-grandparents, 16 second greats, 32 third great-grandparents. He's for you. He's your fourth great-grandfather. So you've got 64 fourth great-grandparents. Something that one person did meant that you are who you are today.
Sure.
If Xerxes had not escaped, what I learned about studying the prison camp there, if he had not escaped, most of those Iowa soldiers were moved further south than Texas to another camp where the majority of them died. This is towards the end of the war. The camps are not in great shape. The Confederates have no money to feed anybody. They were not taken care of at all. And most of them ended up dying. It is not likely that he would have made it back home. When he got back home, his first wife died shortly thereafter, and he married his second wife, our ancestor, Nancy Catherine Smith. And in 1867, their first daughter, Nellie Mae Knox, was born. And she's your third great grandmother, little grandma. Your grandpa met her and teased her and called her little grandma because she had a waist about this big, little tiny thing. Anyway, I've got pictures of him. I can send them to you. It's he seems to be a very kind man in his pictures. He's got this face, and you think, oh my gosh, what did he go through? And then to go back home, to report back, to get discharged, he went back home and a bunch of them started a militia. So at the end of the war, they were worried about how things were going to be at the end of the Civil War. How were things going to be at home? And to keep things calm, they formed a militia just to kind of protect the area for a while. So even after being held prisoner, he still participated to protect his home. And then he was a farmer. He lived in Exira, Iowa for the rest of his life and had eight kids. He's got a kid named Grant. He's got another kid named Sherman. So he's named them after Civil War generals. And he quietly lived out his life until 1920. But it's like, how did that story not come down to us? How is that recorded in history, but not in our family history until one of us digs for it? And so it made me think, if he had not done that, I wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be here.
Sure. Yeah, I think about the sequence of events that's required for any current present situation all the time. And how nuanced it all is. And I tend to be pretty deterministic in my outlook. I think that everything that is going to happen is just a consequence of what has already happened, that the future is inevitable. But it's interesting to learn about how we got to where we are for a number of reasons. But as far as like how a story like that might have escaped, you know, just how we talk about our family. Mm-hmm. It was probably very common. It was probably a very common story at the time. You know, there's nuances to that that make it uncommon, but to talk about being captured, that's not something that you would talk about very much. That's one that you would probably avoid. The details of what it takes to survive is not good. Not good in any circumstance like that. So there was probably things that he wasn't necessarily proud of. To stay alive for a month on foot, I think, is probably the most remarkable aspect of that. Just the sheer will and determination to survive, and probably a lot of help from people who will forever be anonymous. Because that's just not something that you're able to do on your own. In the Civil War, way more people died of illness and dysentery, especially, than were ever shot. But and then speaking to the artillery bit that you asked about a little bit before, heavy artillery, we think of the Civil War as troops lining up across from each other with muskets and bayonets and marching in order across these picturesque meadows and battlefields and hills. It was an artilleryman's battle. Stonewall Jackson grew up in the artillery. He used artillery better than anyone else in the war, and he was the most effective general in the war because of that, because of his maneuver and his artillery. It's definitely something worth considering. Another interesting thing, and I brought this up recently with a friend of mine who's still in the Marines, they used a lot of canister rounds in their cannons, which mm-hmm. would just be a lot of like small balls, like marble sized balls. The capabilities of the Civil War canister round is actually really similar to the canister round capabilities in the M1A1 Abrams main battle tank today. So we still use that cartridge, albeit in a much more advanced platform. But the effects of it have largely remained the same. And I think that's fascinating when you have a piece of military technology that doesn't change much throughout mm-hmm. large periods of time. But yeah, Xerxes sounds like a hell of a guy. Would have liked to have met him.
I would love to meet him. If when we get the time machines built, I'm the first one on there, and that's who I'm talking to.
Yeah.
I would like to know. I don't know. I've got a picture in my mind of what I think he's like, because he's got in the pension file, every time an act was passed by Congress to increase the pensions, I think he started out getting $8 a month. And by the time he died, it was around $20 a month for his pension. But they'd have to go to Congress and pass an act, and then they'd have to go back in town and have a doctor look them over. So I've got his medical history, what he looked like. I've got a couple pictures of him too, but as far as like color of his hair, color of his eyes, height, weight, what he was suffering from or not suffering from. And then affidavits, again, signed by witnesses of what they were soldiers with him, or the one guy was a prisoner with them, I think. And so, you know, just kind of getting a feel for what he's like. I feel like I know him. Like when you study somebody in your family this long and you see how they moved, and I'm in the middle of writing, because I've studied him for over 35 years now. I'm writing a biographical sketch about him. I thought, if I get nothing else done in our genealogy for our family, I want to write his story, because I think he's an amazing ancestor for us. I do also want to write about the two Nash boys and the wars there. And so that's why I bite the background history on the Dakota Indian Wars. I like to know more about that experience too. In his will, his wife died. Our my third great grandmother, your fourth great grandmother, Nancy, died in 1909. And so he was a widower for 11 years. And their daughter, Luella, was their second daughter. She never married, and she took care of both her parents. And in his will, he talks tenderly about her and about what he's leaving to her for caring for them. So I get, you know, you can, even though I've never met the man, obviously, he was gone long before I was born, I feel like I know him through these documents of his life and the experiences that he had. So I'll send you a couple pictures, because I think you'll like his eyes.
He died in 1920.
Yes.
So.
Born in 1834.
Yeah. So he was alive during World War One.
Yeah.
Wow. We just don't think about how young our country is and how few generations have occurred. You know, you don't think about a Civil War veteran watching a world war break out
mm-hmm.
and the U.S. sort of trying to figure out where they stand and all that.
Just
insane.
The previous generation, my grandparents, your great grandparents, Granddad was born, Chief was born in 1902, and Grandma was born in 1907. So they lived through both World War Wars, the Depression, clear up through landing on the moon, you know, going from living, getting homesteading and trying to get free land and make a go of it for your family through we're landing men on the moon. That is, and my other two grandparents on my dad's side, the same thing. And it's amazing to me. Cars, you know. Oh my gosh, James, never try to research anybody in the 1920s with the name Nash, because everything that comes up, I was looking for Granddad in a certain place in Minnesota, and every hit I was getting on my searches was a Nash car. It was big news when somebody got a car. It was like, and so they'd say, so-and-so bought a Nash sedan, blah, blah, blah. And they would describe it. It was part of the news of the day, because it was weird and new. And so, yeah, you think about the military history, you think about the history of technology and just all of it, what they've lived through. It's an amazing thing. And my grandparents, not all four of them, they had hard lives. They had really hard lives compared to, you know, on my dad's side, I've got homesteaders in North Dakota that lived in sod houses. And so it's like, oh my gosh, my microwave is on the fritz today. I'm having a hard day. No, I'm not. My great grandmother lived in a house made out of dirt. So no, you know, it's to me, a lot of it is, it puts things in perspective. It puts what my life is in perspective. And I can't be anything but grateful for everything that everybody did. I thank God every day that they came all the way out west too. The decisions they made to make them do that.
Yeah, no kidding. So where do we go from Xerxes?
Well, I was just going to say more recent than, so for Chief and Laverne. So they got married in 1926 and went up to Saskatchewan because there was homesteading and lots of land up there. And they had been up there previously.
So was Xerxes Chief's dad?
No. Xerxes is on Grandma's side and Ruth's side. On back over here to the Nash side. Chief, your great grandfather, my granddad. He was a family man. He was a really good family man and a hard worker. But he, his dad, I can't figure this one out. His dad was the one who was born in 1873, right after his dad died from the Civil War. So yeah, again, we're not that far removed from our Civil War soldiers. Anyway, but his dad went down to Mississippi, Monroe County, Mississippi, in 1898. He met his wife down there and married her, and their first son was born down there. And then they went back to Minnesota and lived, and granddad was born, and another child was born, Falvey. And then they went back to Mississippi, and their daughter was born. This is not a normal migration pattern, going Minnesota to Mississippi back and forth. And I'm still trying to figure out why he went to Mississippi in the first place. I've got a couple of theories, but that's where he met his wife. And then in 1915, they decided to go homestead in Canada. And so they crossed the border into Canada in 1915.
Now, I have a question about this.
Yes.
I heard the chief killed a guy, and that's why they moved to Canada. He was fleeing justice.
Nope.
False?
False.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the glorious, let's make a reason for why he's going by chief and not Otto. And it's a lot more simple than that, but no, he didn't.
Okay.
There's no record of that at all. What he went for is his dad first went up there. His mom and dad went up there and they lived there for a couple of years. They crossed over the border in 1915. This is James Henry Nash and Sarah Alice Morgan and their four children. And then James Henry Nash died in 1919, he's buried in 1920. Anyway, he died and he's buried just outside of Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. And then after that, there's a great big gap of records and time. He told my mom, he said that his dad died. He just dropped dead in the field and he was only 40. He was born in 1873. So he was only 43 years old, I think. He was very young when he died.
I've been building fence in rocky ground this week and I get it. I was close to there yesterday.
You were almost dropping dead in the field.
Yeah. I was one more refused post away from just giving up.
Well, and I think it was heart related is what we assume. Anyway, so he's buried up there. And after that, his son, your great grandfather, granddad Nash, he was a teenager by then, and he ended up kind of wandering a little bit. And his mom, I'm not clear, she ends up back in Minneapolis with her daughter. But two of her sons are living in a household in the 1921 census with a Seventh-day Adventist couple in Saskatchewan, and Chief is somewhere else. So the feeling I get, and the records are sparse. I have not found them in the 1920 census in the United States or the 1921 in Canada. I can't place where they are once dad dies. But what's clear is dad dies and the family can't support themselves. They scatter. And so granddad, from that point on, he's a little lost. He watched his dad die. He's 19 years old. I've got a couple of things I'm still in the middle of trying to prove and show. So I don't want to talk about him yet until I make sure I know them right. But I end up finding that he does end up in Minnesota in the household of, and it took me forever to find because it was indexed incorrectly, but his uncle, Wren Nash, and his uncle is there and he's with him then. And I think about it and I realize, okay, he went back to his uncle. Dad died. Mom went back to Minneapolis and he's on his own. He went and went to be with family. And it was comforting to me when I could finally pin him down. That's when I was finding all the Nash car references. But I could pin him down and say, look, now I see where he is. He's with his uncle. He went back to family. So then he's looking for work. He ends up going from that area of Minnesota. It's lower southern Minnesota. He ends up going to the Dakotas. He found work on a farm, the Ira Johnson farm, and supposedly tripped over the sow and broke his leg. And then grandma nursed him back to health and they got married. So he marries grandma in 1926 and then takes her. He goes back to Minneapolis to see his mom to introduce his bride to his mother. They have their photo taken, their wedding portrait. And then he's got his brother, Valvy, and the three of them go to Canada. And then that's where your grandpa was born and your grandfather, Lyman, and where Uncle Lionel were born. He had a butcher shop up there in Canwood, Saskatchewan. He had cattle and the Depression hit. So he's newly married, got a couple of kids. He's trying to make a go of it. And things are hard anyway. Life is really hard, farming, cattle, all of that. And he lost everything. And they did everything they could to sell the cattle that he could through the butcher shop. But I've got some of that on the history of Canwood, talking about that time period and who the next butcher was. Anyway, and so he sent grandma back to South Dakota, back to her parents with the two boys. And he went ranch to ranch looking for work. He worked in different places in Canada. He worked in Montana. He ended up getting a job on a ranch in Cut Bank, right outside of Glacier National Park. Gorgeous through there. He worked on a ranch there, and then he got the job in Alturas, California in 1939 and sent for grandma and the boys, and then got another job in the ranch down in Loomis, California. So he, during that time period, and I can't find records of it, but he participated in the Calgary Stampede. He was in lots of different rodeos. He was trying to make money any way he could. He got a few letters where he's writing back to grandma, called her Girly, and would write back to her and send her money, keep in touch. But it was a rough time period for him because he's trying to support, he's, you know, newly married, got these two boys, and he's trying to find a way to make a living. Mom says he was never not working. Like, he always was looking. He would do any kind of work. He drove truck. He drove a beer truck. He drove a water truck over what is now Donner Pass. When they were building the pass, he was driving the water truck there. He worked in rice paddies. He worked anywhere he could find work for his family. And it's interesting because we were watching some show or movie the other night, and this family was starving. The dad wasn't supplying food. Mom says that's something that never happened. We always had food. Daddy always made sure we had food, and we had what we needed for school. And education was huge for granddad. Education and reading and doing better. So it is this kind of stuff, when you look back and you realize how hard their life must have been, and you realize what was important to them and what they passed down, it just, even though I didn't know him as an adult, he died when I was a child, a teenager. I feel like I know him as an adult, you know, recreating their lives and trying to understand what it was they went through.
Yeah.
I think we got a lot to be proud of in our family.
Sure. And even the parts, you know, like the Dakota Indian Wars, you know, we've looked through that in a modern lens, and it's important, I think, to not judge people by how we feel today. Like, you have to look at how would they be judged then. And there are things that don't pass that test during any time period, like that, you know, some things are bad all the time.
Yes.
When you're talking about, you know, conflict, military conflict, somebody loses every time, and there's not a gentle way to do that. That's chief is the one that, you know, Dad and Uncle Kenny and, you know, people talk about as like this larger than life figure. Yeah. And there are so many stories that surround the guy. He's the one that I want to know the most about, and we still have, you know, we still have relics. Like, I think there's, you know, a moose hide jacket and, you know, muzzle loader. And there's a handful of things around that were his that are interesting. I know that he killed a moose in Saskatchewan with a muzzle loading shotgun when he was out bird hunting. And he ended up stuffing a chunk of willow down the barrel and killing it with a piece of willow instead of the shot that was in the shotgun. Just these incredible stories.
Do you think that one's true? Because I mean, is that possible? I don't know about guns, so you got to tell me that part.
Yeah, for sure. You'd
Okay.
have to get
All right.
close. You'd have to get close. I think I could pull it off. You know, if somebody said, "Hey, here's a muzzle-loading shotgun and some powder, and you go do your worst," I could figure it out. I could get that done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's secrets. There's secrets in his life, but there's also, I think a lot of it comes when I look at it now and think, well, his dad died so young. And his mom went back to Minneapolis and she ended up remarrying a man who was younger than her. She lived with him first for several years before marrying him. And
Scandal.
it's she was a bit of a cougar and she was doing some stuff. And so part of what he did not like his mom doing that. So there was some aversion to talking about her or her situation. There was aversion, I think, to, you know, it made him sad thinking about his dad. So I think there's these some of the stories that are made up. And I think this is what happens in every family is you're trying to explain why are there gaps in knowledge or gaps in time of the person's story. Well, there's certain periods in their life they don't want to talk about. There's certain things that they went through. It's behind me, I'm moving on. And so then the larger than life stories come out of some of that. A lot of it, like I said, I think a lot of the stories, there's a grain of truth. It comes from something, but sometimes they're embellished to try to understand that person better or to glorify something a little better than whatever it was.
Yeah.
We don't have famous ancestors. We all don't come from Indian princesses, which there's no such thing, by the way, but those are the kinds of things that get passed down. And then people want to hang on to that because it sounds wonderful. I think the things our ancestors did on their own is glorious and wonderful. The fact that they did it, that they made it, that they helped, that we are where we are today is because of them, because of their fortitude. And not just the men, but the women too, that the hard life that they lived and going through what they did. I think all of that's amazing and wonderful. We don't need to be famous and have famous ancestors or bigger than life stories. Just the fact that granddad did what he did for his family. He made sure education and reading and all of that was important to kids,
Yeah.
to his kids. And he was big on later in life on the 4-H and FFA and all of those things to help educate and move on, which sent your grandfather to UC Davis to be the cattleman, which sent you know, and it's funny because it drives a lot of what your dad is doing today, whether your dad knows it or not, with his involvement in trying to get laws and things. You know, that help make life better for everybody.
Right.
And getting involved in a little bit of politics when we go back on the Nash line and even the Frederick line. So Xerxes' daughter Nellie married Albert Frederick. He's a farmer in Exira, Iowa, there in Audubon County. He's got Herefords. He's got a ton of cattle that he's working. He was well respected. He was involved in politics in that area. I've got several instances where some of our Nashes were justices of the peace. Several of them were ministers. Clearly, there's like a proactive, let's fix this kind of mentality that comes down in our genetics as well. In what you're doing today.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, how rapidly is genealogy changing? Like, if we were to fast forward two generations, right? My generation has been, journaling what they do on the internet like almost daily since 2010.
I know that just seems like that's going to be a nightmare for a future genealogist.
It's going
Just,
to be a lot to go through, but there's going to be a lot there as well.
well, and photos. Like we have so many photos. I was thinking about it that earlier, you know, when photos of families came out, it was precious whether you could afford to go have a photo taken or not. You get one photo or what have you. And then you come forward, you know, even when I was a kid, it's like you could get 18 pictures on a roll of film or whatever it was, but everybody better have their eyes open because we're only taking one shot at it. And you come forward to the 80s where you get double prints for everything. And now we've got digital pictures and we got 5,000 pictures of what I had for dinner last night. It's ridiculous where we've gone in just the recording our daily life. Much less than, like you said, the blogging and the writing and all of that. So there's going to be a lot. I think personally, we all need to take control of our own story. We can do that by writing whatever we can do about that to make it clearer for future generations. Because, you know, these people that were that I'm studying, that I'm talking about, they didn't have time for all of that. They were out farming and they were making a life for themselves and their kids and putting food on the table. So I'm cobbling back to together the stories of their lives through the records. You know, when and where they bought land, when and where they were moving here, when and where they participated in a military event or whatever, and trying to form who were they as people based on all of that. So we should have a clearer picture, but yet maybe diluted because we've got so much to go through.
Yeah.
For, you know, your generation and those coming after.
Well, and we live during the time of filters now in so many ways. And in so many ways, it's not just, you know, the way that a photo appears, but we're moving quickly towards this augmented reality, virtual reality thing where it's going to be incredibly difficult to detect who a real person is rather
what's
than
real and what is
the
it?
Avatar that they present. And that's going to create a lot of challenges. Okay. The part two that I wanted to get at for people that want to learn about their own family history, where do they start?
You start with yourself and you start at home. So most people get into genealogy because there's usually a life event happens and they're like, you know, either a close call with death and they're thinking about where did I come from? Who am I? Or they have a midlife crisis or it's a retirement thing when they get older. That's kind of traditionally been what it is. With the advent of the internet, we get more and more younger and younger people being involved and being interested, especially if they've got a bent towards understanding history to begin with. But you start with yourself. So what do you know about yourself and your parents? And you work from there. You don't jump from yourself to the Revolutionary War ancestor. We first have to prove my parents are my parents, their parents are theirs. And you go backwards in time to prove each connection. There's software, there's apps and, you know, for your phones and things, there's software for your computers and there's online trees. So any of those will work, but like Ancestry, you can get at ancestry.com, you can get a free account and build your tree online. They have a subscription if you want to get access to records, then all the records that you might use to attach to the people, but the tree part is free. So you can start building it on there and putting in everything that you need. But you start at home, you talk to the older generations, who's still alive. Who knows? Obviously, you talk to your parents. You come talk to me, James. That's what you do.
Yeah.
You talk to me because I'm the one with it. But you find the aunts and uncles, the grandparents, and you ask them, what do they know about their grandparents and about the earlier generations? And you start recording all of that. And keep in mind, again, family stories can be glorified. They're not always necessarily true. So the objective to be a good genealogist would be to prove that all of these things are true. To get some sort of documentation. So birth certificates, birth records, death records, marriage records, obituaries. If there's diaries and letters available, and look for photos, look in your home, you know, in the attics of your grandparents' house or whatever, and look for photos, family Bibles, all of the ephemera of life that gives you an idea of who they are. And somewhere in all that, even if nobody in the family currently knows who the great grandparents are, somewhere in all that, there will be clues. And then once you've gathered, you've gone through that compiling and gathering stage and you've got the framework of where you're going to start, then it's like, okay, where would these people logically be living, et cetera. So in the United States, the census was taken every 10 years from 1790 to 1950 is available to us right now. So we can go online. Family Search is a free website with tons of records. The largest collection in the world is at Family Search. And it's free through their catalog and through some of their searchable things. So you can go in and look at the census. So for example, trying to find grandma and granddad, I've got them in 1950. By then, mom's now on the census. She was born in 41. So when the 1950 census came out last year, the year before, anyway, I went in and found mom on there as a child. And that was kind of fun and see Chief and Laverne and the boys. And then I started talking to mom about some things and I started asking her questions and the memories came flooding back because they said, oh, it looks like your neighbors were this person and this person. And she starts telling me stories. Mm. So you prompt people, the older people in your life with something and they'll start telling you, oh yeah, we used to go there for Christmas or we used to do this or that or whatever. Record them. You know, use an app on your phone, use a tape recorder, whatever you do, but record the stories.
Podcast.
Once they're gone, you can't ask them again. And so it's so important to talk to those older generations first before they do go. I used to sit with my aunts and uncles, and I did. I that note somewhere in that closet back there. When I talked to your grandfather, Lyman, and asked him what life was like, what he remembered of Saskatchewan, and I just sat and interviewed him one day and wrote all kinds of notes down. I didn't record them. I think at the time I didn't have a recorder. We're talking back in the 80s, but again, his memories are slightly different than my mom's. There was a big age gap between them. So they remember their parents a little differently. Of course, their parents treat a boy, the oldest boy versus the oldest girl a little differently. So you get different perspectives on the different stories and things, but you gather what you can, put it together, and then you start looking, where would they be at this year? Go through the census and lay out their life. You start looking at, we dig deep on, especially with farming ancestors, looking at land records, where they bought and sold land, if they paid taxes, look for their wills and probate. That will spell out their possessions. And going from there, it's fascinating. And you study the history, because to me, I always loved history in school, but Civil War history was, I don't know, it was interesting, but it wasn't real. But once you start studying these soldiers who are actually my blood relatives, that they were there and this is what happened to them, it becomes real. It becomes more real when you realize we're part of that whole activity and we made part of that happen.
Yeah, the Civil War is a tricky one. And I've been reading quite a few books from each side of the war recently as in like over the last couple of years. The Civil War that I was taught in school was very much the Civil War from a Northern perspective.
Oh yeah.
And it was just wrong. Like the way I was taught the Civil War in school was completely inaccurate. You start to get into the perspective of the Confederacy and man, it gets pretty tough to have sympathy for the Union, especially in the first couple of years of the war. It is really, really tough. And then you read the Civil War history from Ulysses S. Grant's perspective. And then, you find the South loathsome in so many ways. And then you read about Stonewall Jackson. It's like, well, how could the North possibly do this to them? You know, each side feels like the aggressor depending on who you're reading about at the time. And it is a really, really tricky one. World War I history is a little bit easier for us to get into. World War II history, again, it feels like a little bit cleaner perspective, but World War II history is complicated by all the human rights violations that were occurring in Germany and in Japan. So that again feels like this social justice conflict when, it really didn't start that way.
Nothing's ever black and white.
It's very complicated.
It's very complicated. There's politics, there's social issues, there's religion, there's all these things that come into it from, again, different perspectives. It's the same thing in family history. Everybody's different perspective and how you all come at it. It's not easy and it's not black and white. You have to understand all sides. And sometimes for some people, that's a lifelong travel through understanding just, if you just did Civil War research, you could spend your whole life trying to understand all the perspectives on that one.
You could spend your whole life trying to understand Gettysburg. You could spend your whole life trying to understand the maneuver that occurred at Chancellorsville, minor battles. But yeah, it's really, really interesting. And it's fun to develop the complexities of these events and understand that had a single mini ball landed differently, that changes everything that occurs afterwards. It changes the future of our country. And it does come down to millions of actions, all of which have, just magnitudes of consequence if you take it a generation or two down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. And I think it's the same with, as I said earlier, just one small change in what one of our ancestors did, and you and I would not be here talking today.
Sure. Yeah. But here we are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Did I answer the how to get started question? I think so. I think I covered everything.
Well, let's say somebody goes to Cindy's List. Is that the easy button?
Well, kind of. I mean, it's meant to be. I've got a beginner's category, which I probably need to update a little bit because keeping up even with the technology. There's a lot of things that are put in place that almost gamifies genealogy a little bit, the same way a lot of technology things are today. So, like, for example, if you get an ancestry account and you set up your family tree and you put stuff in, you'll start getting hints. So you start get this little hint, oh, you might be interested in this person. And sometimes people who are new to genealogy will look at it and go, oh, that's James Henry Nash. Okay, attach him without looking and seeing that he's from North Carolina, not Minnesota. You know, that
Right.
he's not the right James Henry Nash. Same name doesn't mean same person. So there are a lot of people that don't always use critical thinking when it comes to attaching and things because the app makes it kind of like it's fun, you know, like you're attaching and doing and building. So there's people early on that are basically just compilers. They sort of gather and maybe attach everything to a tree. And then there's some who will actually start looking at it going, wait, that one doesn't make sense. She's dead before her kids are born. She can't be their mother, you know, and start looking at it and putting the critical thought into it. And so that's all I would say. Slow down and look at things carefully and don't be misled by some of the easy ways to get through this. It isn't always easy to find. Even when we've got really good records and I've got a lot of good stuff and family stories, we still got a big gap of about 11 years in granddad's life that I can't make sense of. So, you know, there's ways there where it's not always easy to find. Don't let the technology fool you, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Gotcha. Yeah, I want to know more about Chief. I want to know the answers to some of these unanswered questions, as I'm sure you do as well. So many
I'm
great
doing my
stories.
best. I do have a partially written biographical sketch for him, and I am working on some of his, but I got sidetracked with Xerxes and some other things that I want to solidify. So
Wasn't there a Nash on the Mayflower?
no, you asked me that one other time. Not that I know of, I should
Okay.
say. Ours are in Connecticut. Most of the Mayflower, they tended to be in Massachusetts.
That is not far away.
That's not, but there's a big difference in the political and the religious history of those two states, where it's like, no, you were from Connecticut or Massachusetts. You didn't move back and forth necessarily. Ours, we've got Nash, Rogers, Nichols, one of the other ones, but that are all in Connecticut, going back three generations in Connecticut, from where Abraham was in Richfield, Fairfield County, Connecticut. So supposedly they were in Connecticut going, I mean, we're talking into the 1600s. There's a large family tree on FamilySearch that is a human crowdsourced tree where people add in stuff. It's full of good stuff and it's full of garbage. And so I don't know that the connections they have on that tree, putting us back into Lancashire in England, are correct or not. But supposedly that's where the Nashes were from.
Where is Lancashire?
It's a county in England, northwest England, I believe, north
Okay.
of London.
I'm thinking about going to the UK to go hunting this fall. I've got an invite from a couple people there, military folks. One of them is in the British Royal Marines, one of whom was in the Irish military. And there's some really splendid hunting to be done in the UK, but I would love just to kind of tour around because I've got a lot of Scottish side on my mom's side. She's a McAllister. And then we've got the English side with the Nashes. And those two don't get along well. You know, the Scots
The
don't
Scots and
really
the English.
like the English, and they've got
No.
good reason not to. Yeah, this British Royal Marine I was talking to, I was describing some of that, and he's like, well, that's interesting, because that would not have happened very long ago here. You know, it's just not as much of a thing. But no, it's fascinating to unravel this mystery, and what a powerful tool the internet has become, as these archives become digitized for somebody to access this information remotely.
Well, yeah, because we ended up, like I said, our people are the ones that always went west. So we were the one son that went west with his family over and over and over again till we hit here. So for us in Washington and Oregon, prior to the internet, to get any kind of research done would mean traveling back to Minnesota or back to the East Coast, and it was slow and ponderous, writing to people, waiting for letters, waiting for records to be sent to you, that sort of thing, and expensive. So the internet's amazing because from Washington State, I can sit here and look at records in England and look at records in Sweden. And and get them within seconds. And more and more things are being digitized every day and being put on Family Search, but also in library and archive websites all over the internet. So it's an amazing resource. It's almost overwhelming, the amount of stuff, because I started pulling things out. I got to talk to James today. So what am I going to talk to him about? There's several things that Adjutant General reports of the state of Minnesota that I started looking at again. I was like, oh, wow, there's stuff in there I need to pull. It's a just an immense amount of information to then try to put into a timeline of a person's life and reconstruct their identity and who they were. It's wonderful what we've got access to.
Last question. Yes. It feels like artificial intelligence is about to hit its first real power stroke.
Yeah.
How might that affect the way you study genealogy, and how other people might?
There are genealogists. There's a new Facebook group that covers that. There's genealogists talking about how do we use it for genealogy. It's really meant to be something that helps you write and helps you. I don't feel like it can do what a human brain can do. I can tell the difference between two different James H. Nashes in the records and which one was the father and which one was the son. In some cases, there's no birth record. All you've got in the middle of a Civil War pension file is the birth date for your third great grandfather. And so there's, you know, artificial intelligence doesn't know that it needs to go to the National Archives and pull a pension file that's not yet digitized, but lives on Cindy's computer. And there's a birth record. So there's things that are not, there's no direct lines to all of this. We've got to be able to interpret data from a variety of record sets and pull things out of things to make sense of them. To me, computers and artificial intelligence, they're very logical and they're looking for things to be logical and pull. Well, here's his birth record. There's no birth record. We've got to interpret that. We've got to get indirect evidence of his birth based on this record, and this record all coming together and pointing to this must be his birthplace when there's no other record anywhere that ever says where somebody was born.
Right. So that conjecture element you feel like is lacking right now.
Yeah, I do. I don't think it's going to help in certain things. There's some of my colleagues that are using it they're playing with it. They're trying to see what can it do or what might it do. You could give it, well, help in writing. Like if people are stuck in writing, how do I write about this soldier who was at the Battle of Gettysburg and was this in this unit? You could give it general information and have it write maybe something about him in this particular battle, but we don't know specifically what he himself did there.
Yeah. I think we're going to get to the point relatively quickly where through virtual reality and AI, we'll be able to watch the Battle of Gettysburg, maybe even first person.
Yeah, that'll be good and creepy, I think. I'm not sure what to think about that.
It could be a lot. It could be a lot, depending on its accuracy. I know when... Gosh, I hadn't been home from the Marines very long. There's some traveling writer who'd come through here and was writing about war, who had not been in war. Mm-hmm. And somebody asked me if I'd read her work, and I said no. And they said, Are you afraid that she got it wrong? I said, God, no, I'm afraid she got it right.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. It'll be fun to see. Maybe we should check back in a couple of years on this and see where it's gone, you know, to Yeah. See whether you're correct or not. Okay. If people want to reach out to you directly, can they do that? Is there a way that they can follow along in what you're doing? Or if they need help, can they enlist your services in helping to figure out some of the enigmas in their own families?
The website's free for everybody to use. And it's cindyslist.com. I assume you'll put the link maybe in the show notes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's CYNDISLIST.com. So there's that. Go in and browse the categories. Don't use the search engine. Browse the categories. I've got everything categorized by location, by ethnic group, by religion, by occupation, etc. So, you know, for example, this is a unique record set, James. I started the Cowboys category on Cindy's List because of Granddad, because of Chief. And there's a whole bunch of records out there coming out in archives and libraries for brands and livestock brands and marks. And so you can find ranching information about all of that. I'll be teaching in a course next summer that's not just farmers. I think that's the name of it, that we've developed about farming ancestors and researching them and what their lives were like. And so I do a lot of education. So I've got my speaking calendar, which I'll send you the link for that as well. So I do teaching online, virtually for now, for the foreseeable future. And I have a Facebook group that I am one of the admins and founders of that's called the Genealogy Squad. So that I would love to have people come and join and ask questions there as well. So awesome. I don't do professional research for people yet. I might at some point because I'm an educator and the website, both of those things take up all my time. So yeah. That's the way I help people.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. I loved hearing these stories. I hope that that other people did as well. It's hard to know when you're so close to something, whether this has broad interest or just massive interest to me personally. But my hope is that, you know, through the telling of our own family story and learning about some of these individuals and the terrific and amazing things that they've done, that people will have the curiosity to see, you know, who has done amazing things in their own families and, yes. and to start finding those stories and preserving them so that we can keep passing that along and, you know, learn more about who we are yes. based on where we come from.
Exactly. Perfect. Okay. It was great talking to you, James.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share the show with a friend. You can also rate the podcast and leave a review. Your support allows me to keep doing what I love, which is meeting incredible folks and sharing their stories with you. For more content and photos, follow the show on Instagram at Six Ranch Podcast or me at Six Ranch Outfitters. This episode was produced by Emily Brannigan with original music written and performed by Justin Hay. Art for the Six Ranch Podcast was created by John Chatelain and digitized by Celia Christofferson. Tune in every Monday for a brand new episode of the Six Ranch Podcast. I'll catch you next week.